Welcome back to North Beats. This is your host, Corey Luna. It's been a while. I haven't posted anything since March of 2020. And lockdown was a rough time for a lot of us. I had some issues at work, and it actually took until 2023 for me to really get back to the podcast. Obviously, a lot has changed for all of us. In late 2022, in September, I left my old job of 17 years, and that was a long time coming and a good thing. I've now switched over to a new job, and it's less pay, but I'm happier, and I've taken a lot of time to decompress from the emotional trauma and PTSD that previous job caused me. Okay. But we are back with North Beats from North Beach, as I still live over here in North Beach in San Francisco, and I'm still doing Peaked, as many of you have been listening and watching the shows. I'm really happy that that has grown a lot over beyond what I thought it could be. You know, and Rich Hogben has been the amazing guy he has always been, and we've both have blossomed from the change that we all had to do during lockdown. Peaked went from being a local show in San Francisco for about a year, almost a year, and then we became more. I don't think we've really blown up in, you know, over the internet, but we've had a great success at personally for the both of us, as we've expanded our audience to an international or global audience, and we have actually had international guests, and where we've had people interviewed in Russia, France, and Canada. And really, it's all been part of that virtual show that we've been doing. And it has mostly stayed a virtual show. We did do a 3-year anniversary show in April of 2022 at Mission Synth in San Francisco. And we're going to do another one this year, again, in 2023 in April, at Mission Synth again. We've already set it up. We're going to have your opponent play, which I'm really excited about. He's such a good dude. I've known him for a little over a year now, and I met him through Discord. I think it was through the Golden Shrimp Guild or maybe Earth Modular Society, one of those two groups. And he's just been a delight to get to know a little bit, and I've actually had the pleasure of hanging out with him at a couple of shows in San Francisco, just at Mission Synth, of course. And he's just a joy to be around. Total sweetheart. His husband's a great dude. And it's been really fun. Like, he's a great guy. I'm excited to have him on. And then we have Density and Time playing as well. And that's the creator, Kevin Friedrichsen, who created Resonant Frequencies. Phenomenal guy. I mean, this is something that goes back to 2018 and brought myself into the scene of electronic music in the Bay Area. And from that, all the other wonderful people I've met over the years. And it's been a great thing. And with Rich, and Rich helped me get North Beats back on Apple iTunes podcasts. And I am forever grateful for that. Because now I'm back on doing podcasts. I've reconnected with a couple of people that I interviewed back in 2019 and 2020 that I never got a chance to actually publish their episodes. So I'm going to start out with Tim Thompson, who you may know as the amazing guy behind the Space Palette. If you've ever seen him at Burning Man or the Photon Lounge in San Jose, that's that guy who's just the genius behind it. It's interactive, it's audio and visual all mixed together. The code he's doing for it is phenomenal. He's been working on developing some new features to it, and he's always impressed me. I'm forever grateful to know him and to know how humble he is and what a sweetheart he is. So I'm really excited to introduce this wonderful interview I did at his house in San Jose in 2019. And I'm just now getting it out. I reached out to him to make sure it was okay. He listened back to it and said, it's good. So please enjoy this wonderful and belated episode of North Beats with Tim Thompson.
Joined Apple, and this was before the iPhone, so they used some of their expertise and patents and so on for the iPhone. One of the things they didn't do or didn't expose, the original Fingerworks pads, in addition to X and Y, they would detect the area of the finger, so capacitive touch. It's not pressure, but it's capacitance. Hmm. And if your finger was flat versus pointed, you could tell how much area of the finger was on the pad.
Okay.
And that was the third dimension. So that was the first device I got that exposed a third dimension. And so I used that early 2000s.
And then, still have that prototype?
I can show you some pictures and so on.
Oh, yeah, sure, that's fine. Tim, thank you very much for having us out today. Thanks for agreeing to do my podcast, North Beats.
Sure.
This is really fascinating to see your work up close and personal like this.
Yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah.
We'll have a problem with that noise outside, right?
It'll but it's not a big deal.
You can close those.
Great.
Before you start recording, I'll probably go for a walk so you can do your thing.
Okay.
Just let me know when you start. Yeah. That helps the sound a lot.
Yeah, it does. That's great. Wow. Pretty good.
Much wider.
Pretty good.
So that picture there was these are the Fingerworks.
Oh, okay.
Pads, and so I performed with a group in Oakland called Dud, that they were all musicians doing improvisational stuff, and that was when I started doing visual things. So I created this thing. It was kind of conceptually similar to this one, and the problem was that Apple bought the company and
You couldn't get it.
Couldn't get anymore, and I wanted to create things that other people at least would have a chance of getting. So at that point, I started doing loopy cam kind of stuff.
I guess Fingerworks wasn't around very long.
Yeah, only.
Because I'd never seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Milo, we're pretty much. I think we've kind of started.
why don't you?
We're just going into it. If you want. If you want to take a walk or stay here, it's up to you.
Yeah, I'll take a walk. So I always leave him to do his interviews. Mm.
Okay.
It's okay to leave the front door and stuff, like shut.
Just make sure you shut the front door because I've got two cats and they like to get out.
No problem.
Yep.
Right. Okay. I'll see you in a little bit.
Okay, sure.
Have a good interview.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. But Tim, tell me about how you got started in music and wanting to create what is now the Space Palette.
When I was a kid, starting about when I was 8 years old, I played the organ, took lessons and played the organ. I actually was good enough that I competed in some state fair contests and so on. So I was a musician from early wow. years. And then through college, just playing in a few bands, nothing very good, but just developing improvisational skills and so on. And I didn't have very much money, so back then there was a company called Paia, P-A-I-A, that made Kit synthesizers. And so I worked all summer and made enough money to buy one of their kits, so that was my monophonic, you know, synthesizer, really, really primitive, but that's all I could afford. And then electric pianos and so on. So, but I went to school at University of Illinois, got a master's in computer science. Still just doing music on the side. I mean, this was long before MIDI. 1978 was when I graduated. So I went to work for Bell Labs in New Jersey, doing, you know, software stuff. It was interesting being there when Unix was being developed and promoted and growing in popularity.
Wow.
So, but then in the early 80s, you know, 83 or so, MIDI suddenly appeared. And here were my two loves, you know, computers and music, suddenly colliding. And at that point, I knew I wanted to do a lot of software development of musical things. So I started developing a programming language specifically for MIDI. It's an interpreted programming language called KeyKit. It was called Keynote originally, but when I left AT&T Bell Labs 20 years later, I wanted to make it freely available, so the lawyers had me change the name from Keynote, because there was something named Keynote, to KeyKit. So in any case, so in the 80s and 90s, I incrementally developed this programming language, KeyKit, for my own purposes, my own use, doing algorithmic, real-time MIDI manipulation. The language was modeled after awk, which is a scripting language popular on Unix, early Unix. So I started out as an awk-like language and then gradually added things as I needed them. Eventually it turned into a multi-window GUI thing. I was exploring both, in addition to algorithmic music stuff, I was exploring GUI, you know, graphical user interface stuff. So I kind of used it as a platform for exploring different GUI styles. One version I explored the OpenLook, which was a windowing thing for Unix, and that was I developed an entire version using OpenLook and then threw it all away and developed another system that was a lot better. So I developed a whole GUI and GUI tools, and all of the GUI and the tools were written in the KeyKit language itself, so all interpreted. And because it's an interpreted language, it's still real-time. If you do things with real-time in mind, you can make an interpreted language work fine for real-time stuff. MIDI timing isn't quite as demanding as, you know, audio processing. So I played around with that for 10 years or so. I kept adding things to the language, and then eventually I stopped adding things to the language and then just used the language and developed a whole suite of tools, all personal kind of things. It was actually made available when it was called Keynote. It was made available in the AT&T tool chest. It was a way for Bell Labs and AT&T to distribute tools that people had developed internally that had no, they didn't they didn't use them or didn't want to make money off of them or whatever. But they allowed people to... it was the first example of open source, basically.
Okay.
It wasn't the true open source, but you could still, for a very small amount of money, you could buy essentially a license to use the source code for tools like Bash, the shells, or not Bash, Corn Shell, and Keynote at the time. So when I left AT&T, I got them to agree to release it free for non-commercial use.
Oh.
So complete source code is available.
Wow. Very nice.
So there was a mailing list for KeyKit users, and I actually just got mail today from somebody that I was asking about a product, and it turns out he was a KeyKit user. So because it was an interpreted language, it was interactive, and you could change the code while it was running. So it was very good for iterative, interactive development of musical algorithms. Nowadays you call it live coding. Back then that term didn't exist.
My girlfriend, she's a coder. She'd mm-hmm. probably understand that better than I do.
Mm-hmm. So, so KeyKit, worked really well and allowed me to explore lots of things, lots of different algorithmic real-time experiments quite easily. So nowadays, if Python had existed back then, because Python started in the early 90s, maybe a little before, if Python had existed in its current form, I probably would have used it rather than creating my own language. But anyway, so KeyKit's been a key enabler of experimentation for me.
Is that still the language you use today for your Space Palette?
I used it in the first prototypes of the original Space Palette, and I occasionally use it if I need to manipulate some MIDI files or something. And I use it on my website, nosuch.com. There's some online toys, musical toys, that use KeyKit as the back end language.
Oh, cool.
But I don't actively use it. Nowadays, actually, I just started using Go. So I use C++ for most of the stuff, especially the graphical stuff. So C++. Python I now use for some GUI things, especially in the Space Palette Pro. But Go is a programming language that some of my heroes from Bell Labs, Rob Pike, Ken Thompson, and others have created. It started about 10 years ago. And it just has a style that I resonate with in extremely, it's extremely attractive. They've made a lot of design choices that I really resonate with. So I've started to use Go as a programming language, kind of as a router for internal communication and for handling the MIDI stuff. And my intention is to keep going with that, to do more and more stuff in Go. And it makes programming a joy. Programming should be fun, and Go has that as a goal.
I think that's the reason why I've never really taken to it beyond HTML, which I've been told is not really coding, but
yeah. Right. Yeah, so I mean, programming takes a certain kind of person, I suppose. But things are just have gotten obviously better and better. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I first started, I was programming on punched cards.
Wow. That's fascinating.
At University of Illinois was actually an interesting place to go to school at, because they had the system called Plato, P-L-A-T-O, that was unbelievably ahead of its time. Somebody finally wrote a book about it. It was a networked, campus-wide networked computer system with terminals all over campus. Every terminal was a 512 by 512 resolution plasma display, orange display. This is a 512 by 512 bitmap graphical display at the same time that I was using punched cards in the computer center. So Plato was the, there was a notes file system that was a precursor to, well, to Usenet and all of our social media stuff. Anyway, so I grew up in that world, but again, I started with punched cards, so things just keep getting better and better, and languages and environments keep getting easier and easier to make use of. So,
yeah, absolutely. And so, all these languages and for codes that you've been developing and learning have brought in, and your musical background, have all these have seemed to have inspired you to create the Space Palette.
Right. A lot of what I've done is usually taking advantage of whatever the latest technology is. MIDI being the first example, and all the synths and so on. In the early 2000s, well, in the late 1900s, and then, 1990s, in the late 90s, in the late 90s, game controllers became a really interesting hardware technology, if you will, and USB for connecting them. So
yeah.
I've used Windows from day one, and still use Windows to this day because of its, they value compatibility, so I don't have to worry that my code will break when a new release of Windows comes out. That's not true in the Macintosh world. So I love Windows for that. In spite of being a Unix, you know, I'd love for all of my stuff to be based on Linux, but it just doesn't have the support for things I want. So in any case, so in the late 90s, game controllers and USB allowed me to connect, you know, interesting hardware devices to the computers I was using. And so I started developing interesting experiments and instruments, if you will, using game controllers like dance pads, Dance Dance Revolution, joysticks, and so on. So I was still doing purely musical things, always MIDI-based, taking advantage of soft synths and so on. In the early 2000s, graphics suddenly started getting cheaper, and hence more interesting. So you started getting cameras, basically cameras and graphics cards for computers, you know, got cheap enough and fast enough to do interesting real-time graphics. Almost everything I've done, both musically and graphically, is all real-time, you know, instrument kind of things. So I almost never record or make tools for recording. It's all real-time stuff, either myself or other people. So early 2000s, graphics got interesting, and I'd been doing, you know, algorithmic music stuff for literally decades at that point, and so I was ready to start doing something in addition to that. So graphics got cheap enough, and so that's when I started getting into graphical things. Using these Fingerworks was a company that made these pads about the size of an iPad. This was, you know, before the iPhone even. So the company Fingerworks made these pads, and they were capacitive sensing and multi-touch. So this is like the first widely available and cheap multi-touch capacitive device.
And when did they come out? What year were they?
Maybe 2003-ish, early 2000s. I think it was University of Delaware, maybe. So some professors, a university project, and they had some products. They made the what I consider a kind of a mistake to make a QWERTY keyboard. This was back when people were, you know, starting to be concerned about carpal tunnel syndrome from keyboards, and so Fingerworks created a capacitive touch keyboard, completely flat, you know, no travel, but capacitive touch with a QWERTY keyboard, and people bought them and, you know, could type on them, but it was just, I don't think it was a very good application of their technology. So they spent a lot of time going in that direction as opposed to just making a expressive finger painting pad, which is what I think is more interesting. The interesting thing about the Fingerworks pads was that not only was it multi-touch and capacitive, it sensed the area of the fingers. So if your finger was flat, it would sense more area. If your finger was, you know, pointed, less area. So that finger area was the third dimension, and you could get access to that through an SDK and make use of that. And I used that in a graphical instrument, very much like the current Space Ballot Pro, for drawing things. So that third dimension got used for the area of, or the size of graphics and so on. So I developed an instrument making use of three of these pads and a bunch of sliders, and I started performing with this improvisational musical group based in Oakland called DUD, D-U-D. They were all improvising musicians, and I was just starting in visual things. So I was doing just visuals, both with this instrument, doing graphics, but I also started playing with cameras. Cameras, again, got cheap, and around that time, there was a standard called FreeFrame that started getting developed, which is like a plug-in standard for graphics, very similar to VST plugins in music. VST plugins completely transformed, you know, music,
yes,
the entire industry, just based on a simple standard that everybody agreed on. MIDI, you know, is another incredibly successful example. But if people don't agree on a standard, then your market doesn't coalesce. FreeFrame is it's like VSTs, but for graphics. Rather than floating point numbers flowing in and out of the VST plugins, you've got OpenGL contexts flowing in and out of these FreeFrame plugins. The internal API of FreeFrame is almost identical to VST plugins.
Hmm.
Really, really interesting. And I thought that FreeFrame plugins would transform, you know, the visual industry the same way that FreeFrame would transform things just like VST plugins had. Unfortunately, that hasn't yet happened. FreeFrame plugins are, there's maybe a couple hundred of them out there, but it's kind of stalled. A number of the VJ apps like Resolume and I don't know if VDMX supports it. But it's a standard among the VJ apps, so it had a little success. But at that point, I started using FreeFrame and used the visual effects to do real-time things. With a camera, I created this instrument called LoopyCam, which is a handheld camera and then a controller. The first version used a joystick, you know, a game controller,
yeah,
and a camera. And so with that and some code on the laptop using FreeFrame plugins for video effects, that was my first visual instrument. And so it had a long cable, and I could point it at whoever, whatever was interesting, especially moving things. And then loop, the key, and why it was called LoopyCam, was because I could, with the camera, I could capture capture video and then loop it immediately with whatever length loop I wanted, all under my control from the joystick controller and process video effects. So, and up to 8 video loops can be recorded in real time, and they can be while they're looping visually, they can move around the screen and grow and shrink, and so all very interactive. The second version of LoopyCam used a number pad and a little LCD display, which gave you more options and more feedback about what was going on. The other interesting key to LoopyCam is that it uses a security camera, and security cameras have, you know, infrared LEDs, and they will automatically switch between, if there's enough light, it'll be color, but if there's not enough light, like in a dark club or complete darkness, it'll turn on the infrared LEDs and you get black and white output. So it's the perfect, and I didn't have to do anything, you know, to enable that. It's all in the camera. And security cameras are, you know, were even then were pretty cheap. So it's the perfect visual instrument for any light situation, you know, and a lot of times I'm at Burning Man or clubs or whatever. So that was a key enabler, interestingly enough, for that visual instrument. So I started getting into visual things in the early 2000s.
That's really neat, man. Wow. And so from the from Dud and in the early 2000s, where you start using these cameras and getting more into the visuals, mm-hmm. Is this where you start imagining what you really want?
Right. At the same time that graphics got interesting, I discovered Burning Man. So 2002 was the first year I went to Burning Man. 2003, I did a big installation at Burning Man, this big lyre with using the dance pads in front of it. So that was, and I used, they had light ropes as the strings of this giant harp, and so the light ropes would light up corresponding to the pitches of the notes you were playing on the pads. So that was kind of a crude visual instrument. So Burning Man's been a big opportunity for whatever I create. But then as I get more and more experience with visual things, both camera-based and graphics with OpenGL, then I started wanting to combine the two, both music and graphics. And since fingerworks, that those pads that sense the finger area, that exposed me to three-dimensional input. So at that point, you know, I was interested in three-dimensional input, graphics, and music. But I couldn't, there wasn't any widely available three-dimensional input device because Apple had bought it. The iPhone was used some of their technology, and in fact the iPhone could sense the finger area, but at least in the first half a dozen versions they didn't expose it to the in their SDK. So there's no device that could provide, you know, three-dimensional input. And then the Kinect came out, so the Microsoft Kinect, was the fastest selling consumer product of all time at that point. It hasn't really succeeded, an amazing, you know, breakthrough product. And here was, you know, an easily available three-dimensional input device. It was free space input, but, you know, it was still pretty interesting. So at that point I started playing with using the Kinect as input device, and I always want more control over what's going on. So most people, when they use the Kinect, it's just their body in front of the Kinect, and that's it. And
right.
There's body tracking of your limbs, but it can be challenging to come up with control styles.
As you were showing me with that particular model that you have with the Kinect, mm-hmm. and the visuals you were showing me of on mm-hmm. the on the screen, where you actually have the diagram where it's showing and tracking, mm-hmm. you had to program the entire algorithm.
Yeah. I use open source things. So in the case you're describing, the Kinect came out. They have their SDK for doing body tracking, but I wanted more control, and so what I, in addition to them doing the body tracking, they will also give you a raw depth map. So they give you an image where every pixel is not only a color, but a depth.
Okay.
So, and fairly easy to do that. So they provide that SDK. So I took the that image, and then you can process that with image processing libraries. So there's a library called OpenCV, which does, I think Intel released it, that does, it's for computer vision. It's a toolkit for computer vision things.
Okay.
Completely open source. And so that, I use that to do blob detection of these images that the Kinect was putting out. So I didn't write the blob detection, but then I used that. I created a program. The technique I used to give me more control was to put a frame in front of the Kinect, a big frame with holes in it, and essentially train the software that I wrote to understand the areas of the frame. So every big hole in the frame becomes a three-dimensional mouse pad in midair. You know, and because the Kinect gives me the depth of everything, I'm standing behind the frame, and it's seeing all my, you know, the pixels of my body, but because they're further away than the frame, they're ignoring it. They're ignoring my body, but paying attention to anything from the frame forward. So that, you know, was the key thing that the Kinect provided automatically. And so that's what I used to create the original space palette. I started exploring the technique with some just picture frames. Realized, you know, that it was an interesting direction to go in. So kept working on that. 2011, I took an early version of the space palette. It was a rectangular one to Burning Man. It was too complicated. It wasn't that complicated, but it was too complicated for an interactive installation.
The
kind of things that I'm targeting, I call them casual instruments. That, you know, it's an interactive installation, but the goal is for it to be an instrument that people can play, and they're the ones, it's like a blank canvas, and they're the ones controlling it.
Casual instruments, would you have, is that how you would describe the space palettes?
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's a...
That's your term for what you created.
It's my term. Casual games is a common term for,
right,
you know, Angry Birds and things that are immediately engaging, very simple semantics, user interface, you know, so just immediate satisfaction and enjoyment and so on. So casual instruments is the exact analogy. Making an analogy. So most musical instruments, for historical reasons, you know, haven't been able to take advantage of new sensors and so on.
Right.
So, and just historical accidents like the layout of a piano and stuff are they're not designed to be easily learned.
Exactly. You know, with any instrument and most things, you have to put in the time to learn it.
Right.
And with this, you take that away. You just interact.
Right. And finger dexterity. So, you know, every conventional instrument that, you know, people have grown up with require training and finger dexterity and, you know, just more knowledge. And we can do a lot better.
Yes.
You have. Right. That's my goal, is to show and to kind of skirt. Lately, I've been, the initial versions of the space palette was purely a casual instrument. The first version was a little too complicated. Fine if you knew how it worked and were a musician and wanted to control it more. But in 2012, I created the much simpler version of the space palette that had the oval shape. And so that one in 2012 hit a real sweet spot in terms of how simple it was, how immediately engaging it was. And I literally haven't changed that original space palette since 2012.
Wow.
It's such a sweet spot. The next year, 2013, I actually created smaller ones, half size, in pairs, so each person could have their own little space palette and their output would be mixed.
Wow.
Graphically and musically. And I was actually using a different camera. Intel started playing around with 3D cameras. They originally called them Sense 3D. Now they call it Real Sense. So it's a whole line of 3D cameras. So in 2013, I started using these cameras, which had the advantage, the Kinect required like 5 feet between the camera and where the original space palette was.
Okay.
The smaller RealSense cameras allowed me to make smaller palettes and closer range, so a little more compact. So I did that in 2013 and created an indoor tent because in order for it to work during the daytime. One of the problems with the Kinect and any infrared-based sensing technology is that sunlight has tons of infrared and completely wipes it out.
It takes away the sensitivity.
It
overflows it, basically.
Yeah, it makes it...
So you wouldn't be able to interact with it.
You can't use it at all. It just... It'd be nice. I don't know. Nowadays, they're starting to move toward more stereo vision cameras, so to get the 3D depth. So I made these smaller ones and this indoor tent. It was impossible to keep the tent cool, even though I tried.
Right.
Actually, that year was a mistake in two ways. One was creating a tent that I couldn't cool, but the more interesting one was that the original space palette is about 5 feet wide, and people interact by dancing with their hands in these big holes, and it's a very satisfying physical interaction. The smaller ones, it was similar interaction, but in a smaller space. And it's not nearly as enjoyable to play when you're moving your hands, you know, only a foot in a foot wide space versus 2 feet wide space. So, interesting realization after the fact. In subsequent years, I went back to the full, the Kinect-based larger space palette.
And have you used Burning Man is it partly because you enjoy the camaraderie and the place so much, or is it also a way of you to test out your devices?
Oh, definitely both. I mean, it's ridiculously inspiring as a thing, and enjoyable. One way I describe it for me, everybody makes Burning Man whatever they want to make it, and you, so it's a big elephant, and you choose what part you want to take advantage of. For me, I call it the world's largest uncurated art gallery.
That makes sense.
The vast majority of art galleries in the world and artist opportunities are curated.
Yes.
Because there's limited space in the real world. And people have their own style. They want to curate, their own style. But a lot of it is just limited space.
Mm-hmm.
And Burning Man is a place where there's infinite space. there's no lack of space there, and there's no hard curation. So you don't have to spend any amount of time marketing or trying to get into a gallery. You can spend all your time focusing on doing your art. Now, if you have to make a living, that's a different story. Fortunately, I worked in the software industry that pays extremely well, and so all of my art, music things and graphical things, everything has been on the side. So this Burning Man opportunity is just incredibly unique, and I've taken advantage of it big time for the things you mentioned, both the inspiration, the opportunity, and a prototyping environment to try things.
Yeah, I'm still impressed that you actually bring them out to Burning Man and set them up.
It's quite an
ordeal.
Yeah, everything at Burning Man is interesting and a challenge, so you learn how to deal with. I'm not bothered by dust per se. A lot of my stuff, when I come back from Burning Man, I don't dust it off that much, because it's going to get dusty the next year. And electronically, a lot of the things If they get dusty, they still work fine. It's if they get wet, then okay. You got a problem.
All right, makes sense.
So I protect things from. Occasionally it'll rain at Burning Man, but very rarely. So, and interestingly enough, the Kinect, it was surprising to find how well the Kinect works in the midst of a dust storm.
Yeah.
You would think that, you know, because it's using infrared to do its thing, and it just worked fine in dust storms. The first year I put an acrylic case around the Kinect to protect, quote unquote, protect it, but I discovered it doesn't need it. And in fact, the acrylic thing would get dusty.
Oh, you know, and create
its own problem. So since then, I just leave the Kinect by itself.
And so tell me how you went from the original base palette you have with the Kinect to the new version you have, which uses the SensCell morphs.
Mm-hmm. So let's see, when did... So SensCell is a company in... Mountain View or Sunnyvale, they did a Kickstarter, and so they developed. There were a number of companies before SensCell, actually. Tactex was one that were creating pads, pressure-sensitive pads, and actually helped Roger Lin explore a few of those possibilities, including the Fingerworks one. But there was a company, I think it was Tactex. Might have been a different one with a similar name, started by a guy, Ilya Rosenberg, I think. And he did this pad, looked interesting, and it was interesting enough that Amazon bought him. And so he went to work for Amazon. I think they were thinking of using it for their some of their phones or devices. But they never did anything with it. So Ilya then left Amazon and started a new company doing a similar product, namely a pressure-sensitive pad. So that's how SensCell came to be and the Morph. And they did a Kickstarter. The SensCell is a pad that has 20,000 force-sensing resistors in it, beautifully designed both physically and operationally, very easy SDK to get access to the raw data. And so this was, when was it, 2016, somewhere around 2016.
About 3 or 4 years.
They did a Kickstarter that I got a few of them through the Kickstarter, started using them and realized that this is just a mind-blowing piece of technology, and for me personally, a literal dream come true based on my early experience with the Fingerworks pads. Not only was it cheap and amazing, it was also pressure versus finger area. So you can actually get the finger area, but it's really giving you the pressure, and pressure is much more natural way of doing a third dimension. You
know. Yes.
I make the analogy all the time to finger painting. You know, you don't have to teach anybody how to finger paint.
Right. Really.
You just give them some paints and a blank canvas and go to town. And yet you can develop expertise and get, you know, good at it.
Yeah.
Kind of related to sand painters with like Mugraph projectors.
Yes.
That's a really interesting thing. So these SensCell pads are just mind-blowingly fabulous, and for me in particular. And so, you know, at that point I knew I had to create something with them. And because of the success of the space palette, which had these four big holes that essentially gave you, you know, four instruments, four sounds, four graphical things at your disposal. It's like a palette of, you know, four things. And that was a key aspect of the palette, of the space palette, was having four things at your disposal, all three-dimensionally active. So when I got the Sensel Morph, you know, I immediately said, okay, I want four of them. You know, it was like a no-brainer. So then the challenge was to physically do it. And at this point, my goal was not only to create my classic casual instrument kind of thing, but to make it usable as a performing instrument as well. Even the original Space Palette could be used in a performance mode. I could have started developing more interesting hand gestures, either with the holes and or two-fisted gestures, to make it more of a performing instrument. But I didn't do that. But with the Sensel Morph, it has so much control that I wanted to make an instrument that explicitly had a path toward developing a performing instrument with a lot more control. So my design was basically a small oval with the four pads and then a screen, a touch screen in the middle that gives you both feedback and control. And I've, over the last couple of years, gone through a series of GUI, the graphical interface for manipulating things. So I have one interface that's the casual interface that gets used when I bring it to Burning Man, or I just brought it to decompression last weekend. So it's still usable as a casual instrument. People still, you know, very quickly fall in love with it. Not quite as easily as the original Space Palette, because people like dancing and movement. Yeah. And so the original Space Palette is still, you know, more engaging than these pads that you finger paint on, but it's very similar and people definitely enjoy it. But I've also have a second graphical interface, well, actually secret modes in the existing interface.
Secret modes.
Yeah, that let you get access to more intricate control. The casual instrument, you can turn on looping, which itself is debatable. One of the things I removed from the original Space Palette was looping, because if you're looping, it can be hard for people to understand what they're doing and what's being looped. So actually in the classic Space Palette, after that first year, I removed looping, so much more direct interface. With the Space Palette Pro, the casual mode of the Space Palette Pro, I have exposed looping, but it often gets makes things more complicated because people start looping and it's total chaos. But it's there. But it's looping for all four pads simultaneously. Mm. In the more advanced mode, you can control things per pad individually. All the presets in the casual version affect all four pads, but in the advanced version, you can select things individually for each pad. So more per pad control. You can also edit all the parameters of the presets. So I can literally do all of the preset manipulation using the Space Palette Pro GUI itself. So I don't have to touch a laptop or the computer at all, or a keyboard. And that I'm on the third iteration of that more advanced GUI, and I think I actually hit a workflow that is working really well. In fact, I did a performance last night as part of the Looping Festival in Santa Cruz, and so I was able to improvise and use the GUI. So in practice, as a performing instrument, it's now you know, working pretty well. So now I need to work more on enhancing the graphical algorithms and the graphics that I've always done have always been fairly straightforward things. I make them visually interesting by using freeframe plugins. It's like in the musical world, you know, you have a simple synth, but you make it a lot more interesting with chorus and flangers and reverb and all that stuff. Mm. These are all VST, you know, effects. Identical thing in the visual world. You can do real simple visuals and then put them through a few free frame plugins and, you know, it looks fabulous. So I've taken advantage of that. And the key for me is that it's attaching all those graphics to your fingers in real time. So that's where my priority is direct real-time control of everything that's happening, both musically and visually.
I remember seeing, for the first time when I met you at Resident in San Francisco, when you performed on the Space Valley with the Morphs, I was absolutely floored. I was, you know, absolutely mesmerized about the interaction and the visuals that you have going on simultaneously. Mm-hmm. It caught me right away.
And that reflects the casual instrument aspect of it, or maybe just the obvious correlation of, you know, what I'm doing and what's coming out. I mean, when you're playing it, I mean, a lot of people may not realize, if they're watching somebody else play it, they may not realize that their fingers are doing everything, both the note selections and the graphics are all from their fingers. Mm-hmm. This isn't the visuals being generated from the music. It's not music being generated from visuals. It's your fingers doing both simultaneously. And that's highly unusual. I'm not even sure there's anything that's very close to it. But it's immediately obvious when you're playing it, or at least it can be. I mean, some people will only pay attention to the music and they won't even realize the graphics are going on. But kids and most people, you know, immediately understand that they're doing everything and that it's extremely engaging and immersive, especially if you put headphones on. A lot of times I deploy these things in noisy environments.
Right.
So if you put headphones on, now everything you're seeing and hearing is, you know, under your control and
be even more immersed.
It's really working well.
And you were telling me you're developing a little bit more on the visuals?
Yeah, so the graphics I do are you know, literally lines, squares, triangles, and circles. That they're essentially sprites. Your finger painting sprites that grow and shrink and move around on the screen.
Yes.
And those things you feed through free frame filters and they look incredible. But there's a lot more interesting things I could do rather than lines, squares, circles, and triangles. And different semantics. You know, I haven't actually thought too much about them, but I know there's a lot to explore there. Mm-hmm. So that's the direction. I'm actually going to be participating in a week-long gathering of video artists, reflecting the resurgence or the surge in modular synth.
Yes, yes.
Enthusiasm,
which is
overflowed into the video world.
Yeah.
And so there's a group in Phoenix that's going to get together for a week and just have fun interacting with each other. So when I go down there, I might actually work on some of the graphical algorithms.
Yeah, that's going to be really neat. I'm absolutely fascinated by every video artist who's using modular. Mm-hmm. It's really, really fascinating stuff. And even there's Dirty Bill and Drive Avocado. Mm-hmm. What's that kid's name? The younger guy, Jason Warden. Mm-hmm. And who did you mention?
Chris Kanopka or something. Anyway,
I've probably seen him. They're all doing fantastic, unique stuff.
Right. I mean, the modular world. It's really interesting, and it's another example of everybody agreeing on a standard, mm-hmm. And suddenly an entire industry is transformed because you've just decided on the size of the, you know, the panels. Mm. You know, there was a different size. I guess the original Buchla stuff maybe was different.
Yeah.
But now they just put out a Buchla version that's in the Euro rack.
Yeah, it's the red line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Basically a 3U.
So the explosion of creativity, you know, has been fascinating and gratifying and great to see. And overflowing into the video world is even better.
Have you seen the, there's a program or an app that does the modular video? I think it's called Lumens or Lumia?
Lumen, I think.
Could be it's probably Lumen.
There's a handful of interesting video synth kind of things. Touch Designer is one of the big ones.
Touch Designer? Mm-hmm. Okay, have a look at that one. Because I know that Jason Warden, he and his girlfriend will come to Resident and they'll use that. Mm-hmm. If they don't bring out the full modular, they'll mm-hmm. use like from a laptop and set mm-hmm. that up and do visuals along with everybody playing music.
Most of those programs, software-based visual things, are designed, they're very explicitly designed for VJs, and they often are focused on playing video clips and manipulating them in real time with free-frame plugins, but the source is still a clip, a video clip. There can be some algorithmic stuff there, but their focus is playing clips. Whereas in the modular video world, at least initially, there was no modular video stuff that played clips. So people were forced to explore non-clip style video, real-time improvisational art. For better or worse, mostly better, because there's such enthusiasm now in modular video. There are now video modules that are essentially computers, mm-hmm. that can play clips or and so on. So the two worlds are again being merged, but the computer-based stuff has historically been largely clip-based. There's a few programs. I think there's one called Splash, but not ones that I would call a visual instrument. At least that hasn't been their focus. But I think that's gradually changing.
That's really great.
And I do have plans or intentions to open source more of my stuff. The programs I wrote that interact with the Kinect to give you the palette and to interact with the Morph to produce, they both produce OSC messages for the cursor information. I've open sourced those. And I'm willing to give away any software that I've created. The big issue for the stuff I create is usually I'm combining, three or so different things. I'm using Resolume as the host for the graphics. I write a free-frame plugin that does my crude graphics, and Resolume is controllable by OSC, which I take heavily advantage of. Where was I going with that?
With the development of the visuals in connection with the hardware of the Space Palette.
Right. Software visual instruments. where was I going with that?
And this is about your intention to develop more in the
open source. That's right. I use Resolume as the host, like a VST host, but it's for free frames. So I use that, and then I use a VST host, and I use Omnisphere for all the sounds. So I use a number of commercial products, along with lots of my own code, to produce the Space Palette and the Space Palette Pro. So, and I'm willing to give away everything I created, but I can't give away Omnisphere or Resolume. And so the requirements are a little too high. Occasionally somebody will be interested, but it never works out. So my goal is to code more and more of my stuff to avoid using commercial software. That's one reason why I'm starting to use Go. And so I may start removing the need for Resolume, not anytime soon, but this is a long-term goal. And there's open source software synths that are, some of them are pretty amazing. Helm is one, and there was another one. So I think at some point, a couple of years from now, I'd like to see my system be completely open source, using all open source stuff, running on Linux most likely. So that's.
And is the idea with creating more open source of your own code to control the Space Palette Pro? Is there an end goal to make it readily available to people in terms of maybe, you know, in terms of marketing, so that someone could maybe buy it and have it in their home
or perform with it? One of the most common comments I get with the original Space Palette and the new one, there's a handful of comments that I always get. One was, I want one in my living room. I mean, they would literally use that exact phrase. I heard that first few years over and over. And the other question is, you know, how much to buy one. So I've heard that. Unfortunately, for better or worse, I'm retired, so I'm not motivated to make a living off it. You know, if I was, I would be doing things differently. Mm-hmm. But I do want to put it into people's hands. You know, I take it out and show people to expose them to the concepts. But I haven't started trying to manufacture. The original Space Palette was just so big and unwieldy. Yeah. And even the Space Palette Pro is more compact, but still involved.
Yeah.
But I am starting to design a new version of the Space Palette Pro using metal and more carefully documenting, or at least solidifying the design, so that at one level I could just tell people, these are the DXF files, send them to your CNC service and then put it together this way, and all you'd need is to buy the morphs and, you know, run the software. So I also have a mode where, rather than having four morphs, I can take one morph and split it into quadrants.
Oh, cool.
Do that, so for development.
Right, so it'd be more marketable that way, too. So,
right.
So you don't have to buy four morphs, you just can buy one and just divide it.
And even the container for the morphs is, you know, optional. I mean, if I was inclined, I could sell a FreeFrame plugin, which accepts the morph input. You know, so a VJ who wants to perform visuals should just be able to buy a FreeFrame plugin and buy a morph, and they're done. They can run it inside Resolume.
And you could even have a special morph skin for it as well.
For the quadrants. I mean, morph. They sell the morph. They have to sell it somehow, and there aren't that many people who want a blank canvas yet. So they sell these. They sell it with these overlays that give you different layouts of sliders and buttons and things.
Right. Yeah. I spoke to Peter Nybor about that, and I've seen him at. He came out to Resident and did a whole demonstration, and I actually ran into him at Synthplex back in March. Mm-hmm. And he had a whole setup for it as well, and I've seen many of the layouts, and mm-hmm. I even put a booklet one out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, I think they're very cool, and again, it's more of a marketing tool to sell it.
Absolutely, that booklet layout has probably sold quite a few.
Have it.
Just because every picture you see now has the booklet layout.
That's true. Yeah,
and people recognize it, or at least many people do. I think they still have to sell it to the MIDI world, because that's the only thing people. There's enough of a market there to make money selling them, so they have to sell it to those people, as opposed to VJs, because there are no instruments that, you know, make use of it yet. Those overlays are really clever. They have magnets in them, so it can sense which overlay is on it.
You
can change them dynamically. And with the four morphs on the Space Palette Pro, you know, I could put some of those overlays on these one or more of the pads. I haven't done that yet, but I like having, you know, a completely blank canvas. And the morph is about the size of your hand, you know, so at a bare minimum. You know, for development, I can split it into quadrants, but I really want one per hand. So
yeah.
I think for a real performance, you'd still want two of them ideally.
And I think that also goes along with how you describe, you know, this sensitivity of like the, you know, weirs point one, it could be the touch of the tip of your finger, mm-hmm. or it can be your whole hand mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
And that really frees it up by having the bike.
Exactly. Yeah. So the space, similar to when I realized that the big space palette was better than the smaller space palette, because larger physical movement was mm-hmm. more satisfying than smaller one. The same thing applies to the morph. You know, I could have a little trackpad size thing,
right?
But having a thing that's, you know, much larger, that's, you know, fits your entire hand, is much more pleasing and enjoyable to use.
It's probably more ergonomical as well.
Probably, yeah.
And so, I know you were doing a couple of meetups. I don't think you've done one in a little while for mm-hmm. the Photon Salon.
Mm-hmm, right.
And tell me a little bit about that. I've never made an out to one.
Well, I wanted to socialize things I was creating and so on. So about, I don't know, a year and a half ago, I started having gatherings at my house called Photon Salon. Photon Salon, I use it kind of as a brand, you know, for whatever I do. So my installation for the last couple of years at Burning Man has been the Photon Salon, which has the old space palette and the new space palette when I go to decompression. So I use Photon Salon both to cover the gatherings I had at my house as well as when I go out. And fortunately, the resonant frequencies that started up about the same time I started the Photon Salon things. Resonant Frequencies is a gathering in Oakland mm-hmm. that is just amazing and wonderful, and has developed a real community.
Oh yeah.
Bill Wiatrowski and Kevin
Friedrichsen.
So, at that point I realized I don't need to create a community here. It would be a challenge to create one, you know, in competition with that. Mm-hmm. I'm delighted to take advantage of that opportunity up in Oakland. So I'm not really doing any more gatherings per se at my house. I may do, you know, occasional ones. Mm-hmm. There was an event at the Hacker Dojo in Mountain View.
Yeah.
And that gave me an opportunity to give a talk about my work over the last couple of decades, specifically about visual music instruments. And so I develop a talk for that.
That's great.
And I may be giving that talk at other opportunities.
I actually, one of something that kind of came up to me, so you know that I've, a friend of mine and I, we started doing a live meetup called Peaked. And we do it on the third Wednesday of every month. It's mm-hmm. from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. And we just did our seventh show a week and a half ago. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And great, you know, it's a great community. It's a lot of the people that are going to Resonant Frequencies and Resonant, come and check it out. Mm-hmm. We've even got people that are not even playing music at all, and they're just showing up because they're, because mm-hmm. you know, we're in a tech building, so other offices will hear all the music mm-hmm. and we have an open door, so people just kind of come on mm-hmm. in and check it out. And it's been mm-hmm. a really fun thing. And something that came up earlier this year, one of the people in the synth community contacted me and said, hey, there's this guy by the name of Andrew Belt who developed, you know, the virtual Eurorack.
Yeah.
You know about that.
And, oh, sure.
And he said he's coming through San Francisco, the Bay Area, and he's doing some talks. Is anyone want to set something up? So mm-hmm. we did. Mm-hmm. And we had Andrew Belt come by and do a talk on the VCV rack. Mm-hmm. And it was phenomenally wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, he's great. I saw him when he gave a talk at Karma at Stanford.
Oh, good.
And and VCV rack is just, you know, amazing. And I even before VCV rack, I avoided getting into the modular world at all.
Sure.
Because, it would just divert me from the purely software-based thing. It's a lot of fun. I love seeing all the enthusiasm and the creativity. But I didn't want to go down that slippery slope of because I could afford, you know, tons of modules. It'd be a lot of fun, but I wouldn't get any of my own stuff done.
Work done, exactly. But what I wanted to mention to you is that since that happened, another friend of mine, Lachlan Fletcher, actually asked me if I would be interested in hosting him to do a talk on a philosophy of music he's developing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I really want to.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're ever interested, I mm-hmm. would love to set you up with a time for you to come mm-hmm. by and do a presentation
sure.
on your space palettes for the Photon Salon.
Mm-hmm. Where in San Francisco?
It's at Supply Frame in San Francisco, which is on 3rd and Bryant.
Okay.
The Soment District.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually pretty easy to get to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love VCV Rack. I think is, you know, phenomenal and makes it possible to avoid buying all sorts of hardware, but
yes.
still use the same things and have presets.
Mm-hmm.
So, because a lot of people in the modular world, they set up their patches, their patch for performance, and then but they leave that, you know, and tweak it during the performance. But presets, you know, in the modular world are challenging or,
yes.
or even non-existent.
Oh yeah.
So in the software world, you know, you get it for free. So that, and it's interesting. It's almost like a lot of the hardware modules are being reproduced for VCV Rack. It's almost mm-hmm. like the hardware is the prototype of the software of the user interface that ends up in VCV Rack.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, in the long term, I mean, it's interesting. It'll be interesting, you know, in 10 years or 15 years, what's going to happen with all these modules. Because it might go through a similar scenario that early analog synths did.
Mm-hmm.
There was early analog synths like the Juno and stuff like that. Then the DX7 came out, and so the analog stuff was kind of passe.
Mm-hmm.
And the D50 and stuff like that. But then analog came back. So if you caught it in that trough of analog stuff, you could buy them really cheap, and now they're worth a lot. So
yeah.
All these modules, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next few decades.
A lot of people in the community are saying we're in sort of a renaissance period of Eurorack as it's growing.
No question.
And I went up to Velocity in Seattle, Washington, a couple weeks ago, and that was the first time they'd ever done it, and they were it was this wonderful all synthesizer convention,
mm-hmm.
and there was maybe, I don't know, 400 to 500 people that attended, and it was at a relatively small convention center
mm-hmm.
that had maybe like 3 or 4 rooms and a bar like within the center of it, and one main room had the bar inside of it, and they even did like a little pop-up coffee stand in the lobby area for everybody. And again, like all the talks were really fantastic, and again, it's everybody there was enthusiastic. They did workshops where you could even do soldering as well, and teaching you how to, you know, do certain, you know, diodes and fun things like that. And it's really developing a lot, and it's huge out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would say between Oregon and Washington, I would say those are the two key places to go to for modular synthesizers
now. Yeah, LZX is a video modular.
Oh, cool.
Company that's based in Portland, I think. Yeah, it's wonderful to see the creativity in these things. I mean, when MIDI first came out in the 80s, there was a surge in creative musical apps
mm-hmm.
on computers, the Atari ST and so on. M and Music Mouse and stuff like that. Some classic. So innovation just was given a real shot in the arm, and the same thing's happening in the modular Eurorack world.
Yeah.
I mean, just look at the the variety of the modules coming out. It's pretty
neat because, you know, and you're seeing, again, also within the Eurorack community, you're seeing there's strictly analog, and then there's also digital Eurorack modules.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they can work simultaneously together.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's pretty neat.
It'd be nice to have, using VCV Rack as a basis, it'll be interesting to see what what physical instantiations people create. I mean, the ideal would be, something that's like a thing of Tinker Toys or you know, knobs. There have been some attempts at making modular controllers, like with knobs and sliders that you put down on a board in any configuration. The Morph is kind of a soft version of that. So it'd be interesting if somebody could come up with a thing, because physical knobs are you know, much more tactily enjoyable to use than a mouse. If for no other reason that you can be doing multiple, you've got two hands. Mm-hmm. Most computers, no computers have two mice. So, but you've got multi-touch displays and so on. So, it'll be interesting to see what physical instantiations people make with VCV rack and either touch screens or physical things that try to marry the easier to manipulate software modular world with the physical aspects of the physical module world without getting into the issue of buying dozens of modules that
all the gear.
Yeah.
And I think that what you are developing with the space palette, I can see that actually merging with something like VCV rack.
I definitely think, I'd be amazed if somebody isn't working on visual equivalents of VCV rack or things that fit into VCV rack. If I didn't have all this other stuff that I'm doing and pursuing, I would definitely be exploring the visual synth aspect of VCV rack, no question.
Very cool. Well, what is it? Hey, man, this is very fascinating. This is a great conversation. Thank you very much for having me out here.
And
it was
no
really
problem.
Fun to talk to you about this.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, Tim, thank you very much for doing my podcast, North of Beats.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get this edited up a little bit. It might take me about a month or so to get it all together.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to put some of your music at the end of the episode, if you like.
Sure. I mean, like I say, I'm things I do are more real-time stuff. So I don't have any great the recordings I have are of events that I, at Burning Man. Actually, at Burning Man this year, I had an opportunity to take the Space Palette Pro over to this giant pyramid. It was a 70-foot-high pyramid at the Ply Alchemy camp. And so they had 100,000 lumens of projector on this huge pyramid, and they allowed me to come over. This was after the burn, 11 p.m. On burn night. Took the Space Palette Pro over there and projected onto their huge pyramid for half an hour.
Oh, wow.
And I have a video of that.
That's great.
That was pretty mind-blowing. I can definitely give you some links to videos and also the slides for a talk that I've prepared.
Absolutely.
With my history.
Yeah, and I can post any external links you want as well.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be very fun.
Cool.